The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. So we come together this morning to dedicate ourselves to our practice of the Buddha Dharma. And we come together to dedicate ourselves to being of benefit in this world. In our tradition, they go together. They are the same. To cease from harmful actions, to do all that is good, and to study, deeply examine, and understand the nature of mind. And by necessity, by nature, we will all do this from our own place, from where we live, our particular circumstances, from where we are in our own practice, in our own spiritual journey. And so for some, that dedication may still be very much a thing of exploration, not yet knowing whether this is your path. For others, that was made clear a long time ago. And that dedication to the practice of Buddha Dharma and to being a benefit is endowed, infused with that clarity and confidence. As I was listening to Gokhan read the names of all of you, I was reflecting on how for 41 years we have been doing these training periods. I don't actually know, maybe Yushin, if you're out there, you could clarify this. You're probably one of the few, if only, people who could tell us this, but whether in that first autumn when Dada Roshi and those stalwart few moved onto this property, whether they did Ango, that would have been a lot to do all at once. So I'm imagining that they didn't, but Dada Roshi being who he was, who knows? I was also reflecting on how it has been 12 years since Dada Roshi passed, and that we have been doing these Angos without his presence, his physical presence. I read from Master Dogen's fascicle on arousing bodhicitta yesterday. Arousing the aspiration for enlightenment is making a vow to bring all sentient beings to the shore of enlightenment, prajnaparamita. Before you bring yourself and actualizing this vow, even a humble person who arouses this aspiration is already a guiding teacher of all sentient beings. And so Ango is the time when we really consciously and ceaselessly cultivate and strengthen and actualize this vow. And so it's a time of practice, a time of generation, in a sense. It's also, Ango arises out of this ground. Dogen says, the meaning of the aspiration for enlightenment is to endeavor, without ceasing, in body, speech, and mind, to help all sentient beings to arouse the aspiration of enlightenment. Raising bodhicitta, practicing the way of wisdom and compassion to bring forth this great aspiration, to practice with joyful effort, to be patient, and also to cultivate a sense of urgency, to open our hearts and be generous, and within that generosity to be able to focus our mind on the finest of subtleties, to focus in this way, to bring this forward each day in Ango. Ango is a practice. Dogen said it is to endeavor. And so we might all ask ourselves, how tomorrow when we wake up, will we wake up within Anga? Particularly those of you who are at home. How do you wake up within Anga at home? Because without that question or that sense, you will might just wake up the way you do every other day. So how is it different now during these 3 months? The material we sent out, the prompts, the commitment sheet, all of that is to help create, in a sense, help each of us to answer that question. And to be aware of the relationship between what we do in Anga with the Bodhisattva vow. In our relationships, in our work, with our encounters, with people, with strangers, with our planet. Because without that, our daily practice and our zazen can become very isolated, very small. And so we gather together for that very reason, to make ourselves large. When somebody asked Bill McKibbins of 350.org, how can I, one person, possibly make an effect, have significant impact on the vastness of climate change? And Bill McKibbins said, don't be one person. Make yourself larger. Become part of something. And so Anga is that in a very clear way. So we gather together in this sendo at the temple. And so hello to Hojin Sensei and all of you who are at the temple and those of you in the city. In different affiliate groups, our students in New Zealand will be joining us, are joining us. Some of you might be awake in very late or early hours joining us this morning. And in homes across the country, overseas. And so let us remember, having gathered together, what's important and put that in front of us, because we can, you know, it's part of our nature is to forget. When something happens again and again, we become dulled to it, right? We cease to experience it in the same way, with that same aliveness and vibrancy. That's one of the most incredible aspects of Dharma practice, is how to live in a regular life, in an ordinary life, and for it to be continually be coming to life in a real way, not just in a slogan-esque kind of way, but an embodied way. Because otherwise, if we do that, we'll take the teachings and the practices for granted, and we shouldn't, really. They have come down to us through so much unimaginable effort. And much of that effort under great duress. And so let us take refuge in the three treasures, bring forth our aspirations and vows, practice the precepts, trust the eight gates of training. Let us take our seat on this diamond seat, and become that mountain of form that contains within it, as Master Yunmen said, a bright, clear light. Sitting on that seat, we then turn that light around and shine it inwards and deepen our appreciation of having discovered, again, what we might take for granted, this incredible, wondrous art, as Dogen spoke of it, we call Zazen. The fifth ancestor said, calm yourself, quiet your senses, look right into the source of mind. Always keep it shining bright, clear, and pure. Turn the light around. And so how do we use the 24 hours of the day? Master Xiaozhou said we should learn how to use the 24 hours of the day, otherwise we might easily be used by them. And just be struggling to kind of hang on. And that means, as Dogen says, to endeavor in our mindfulness, in bringing that, shining that light on everything that we experience inside of ourselves, thoughts, sensations, emotions, histories, memories, tendencies, reactions, and everything we see in front of us, to open our hearts in compassion. And so to use the 24 hours of the day and everything that arises moment to moment to strengthen our mindfulness rather than create more distraction, to open our hearts rather than close them down in fear, anger, and to see clearly, to gain understanding. Master Linji said, you must right now turn your light around and shine it on yourselves. Don't go seeking somewhere else. Then you'll understand that in body and mind, you are no different from the ancestors and Buddhas. And there is not so much to do. There is not so much to do. In other words, you do not have to become something. The Shuso, the chief disciple, is not here to try and become something. She is here to be completely and thoroughly herself and to endeavor to challenge into the edges of what in her particular mind that might mean. On the Ango board in the back, in the four corners, there are four qualities or points. Origination. Ango and all of its expressions arise out of the ground of being, the mind ground, the ocean of emptiness. The ground from which everything arises. It is unbounded, it is unbiased, it is free and unhindered, it is empty, it is not a thing. And so in a very real sense, in using old images or analogies, we are creating this Ango with all of this that we are bringing together on a cloud in empty space. It has no substance other than what we bring to it. It comes apart together and comes apart in every moment. And what that means is that in every moment we're creating it, not just metaphorically or poetically or even inspirationally, but in fact, virtue, that each day we wake up and establish this basis of our practice, which we could think of and perhaps should think of as not just what I want to be, what I want to practice, but turn it around. Wake up and think, what do I want my influence on the world to be today? How do I want to impact the people that I come into contact with? To train is to live, to face reality, to let go, to take responsibility, to open our hearts, to realize the mind. And it is to appear each day as that person maybe that we're hoping to meet, maybe that we have met and we aspire to realize in our own person. Perseverance. Each day we begin with bodhicitta, raising bodhicitta, that aspiration. Establish your intentions, inner and outer. And again, this is not an abstract, vague thing. If it's abstract and vague, then it is that. It has no power. And so we use the strength of our thoughts and the clarity, particularly when thoughts are focused within mindfulness and our intention. I spoke yesterday about affinity and how important that is. You know, the more heartfelt you feel your relationship with the Dharma, with your practice, with the world, with others, the greater the power there is in that. A vow is not an empty thing. It's not a cerebral thing. It's a guts and sinews kind of thing. It's a all the way down to the bones kind of thing. and it develops. Right? So it often begins sitting on the surface of our skin and begins to work its way in. And that happens because we persevere in practice. We continue to show up. We continue to practice. We continue to engage. And we do that when it's easy, and we do that when it's not. And that's just a simple fact of the matter. It's the only way things worthy of bringing into being happen. Things that take time. Things that have depth. And in that, Dada Roshi used to often use the image of the sword of Manjushri, that liberates us from the sense of self and brings us into life in relationship to others. And he talked about the forging of that sword, going into the hot fire, pounded on the anvil, quenched in cold water. Right, these extremes, right? Hot, burning hot, frigid cold, pounding. Does that sound familiar? Without a path, that can just be being tossed about by the highs and lows. With a path, it becomes the way. The way to forge the heart and mind of a bodhisattva and attainment in simple steps and great leaps. I spoke with a student once who's been practicing for many years, this one, and was remarking on how they felt that their zazen had not really developed very much and it wasn't really very strong and it never really had been. And I said, has your life really stayed the same as a practitioner all these years? And his answer was so immediate. Absolutely not. And he just immediately just came pouring out of him all the ways his practice, his life had changed. And I said, do you think there is no connection here? Do you think that all of that change is happening and has nothing to do with what's going on in your zazen? The theme for the Ango is karma, the path of compassion. And we often think about karma as those actions, those consequences, those paths that bind us because we necessarily put so much energy into our attachments, our entanglements, the obstructions, the afflictions, all the ways in which this gorgeous, free-flowing, bright, clear mind, this aliveness of energy that is within each one of us gets bound up. And when it gets bound up in us, we almost impulsively will go around binding it up in other people. But karma, the very same wheels that are turning and creating samsara are the very same wheels that bring us to liberation. It's just a matter of understanding. It's a matter of faith. It is a matter of practice. You know, and to think about in Trela Kyabgon's book, one of the books that we're studying, and I've encouraged folks to buy the book because we only selected a few chapters to do our focus our studies on, but there are other chapters in the book that are quite good. And he talks about karma as it existed in India as an idea and belief before the Buddha to show how it's evolved, particularly within the Buddha's enlightenment. But just to think about, because we can take these things for granted, just to think about the sort of evolution of human thought and experience as human beings have always tried to understand their world and began to really wonder about the relationship between something that was done and what happened next. An action and its consequence, right? We may take these things very much for granted, particularly as Buddhist practitioners who have studied karma. It may seem like obvious and natural, and wasn't that always understood? But it doesn't seem so. And to just think about this really remarkable, kind of extraordinary and necessary exploration about that relationship, right? Because in every moment we're doing something, we're acting, particularly as the Buddha saw it, with thought. Not just words, not just actions, but thought, intention, desire. Before I've said a word, before I've made an action, already something is happening. Wheels are turning. Things are being influenced. And to think about the implications of that, and for the Buddha, it had such profound implications in terms of a kind of moralizing of the whole world, the human world. That everything we do has a significance in terms of how we as human beings, ourselves and others, experience our lives. And in that every action throughout the day, we have opportunities to bring benefit or to steal it away. And in that way, we realize that although small, each of us in our own lives, brief though they be, they may seem insignificant, but they are not without impact. And in a sense, there's no choice about whether that's true or not. The choice is, what impact do we make? That's the choice we have. The Buddha said, I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond growing old. I am of the nature to grow sick. I have not grown beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond death. Everything that is mine, all that is beloved and pleasing, will be separated from me. To really contemplate that. Everything that I cherish in my world, all of you, this place, this practice, all those that I love, all those that you love, every place that feeds you, everything will become separated from me. And that is the natural order of things. It is not to be possessed. It is to be experienced. I am the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma. I abide by my karma. Whatever actions I shall do, for good or ill, of that I will be the heir. How intimately, inextricably entwined we are with our actions. Our actions create us, you and I. I am born of my karma, not just in this human life, but moment to moment. What is the ground of that birth? What is the mind that brings forth that birth? Greed, anger, delusion, pride, and jealousy. We know what happens next. Wisdom, compassion, loving kindness, patience, generosity. We have a pretty good sense of what happens next. Why is it so important to study and understand and realize the nature of karma? The Buddha said, without this, we cannot study Buddha Dharma. He was quite clear. To study Buddha Dharma is to study and to understand karma. That's not all there is. How else are we to break or interrupt or shift, free ourselves of the cycles that is samsara, that is a universal experience of human beings? Unless we understand those cycles, we already know we can't just will ourselves to break the cycle. Particularly when we see how deep those cycles go and how subtle they are. Shanti Davis said, people don't think I will get angry. They just get angry. And anger doesn't think I'm going to arise. It just arises. All the weak shortcomings that there are and all the various non-virtues arise through the force of conditions. They don't govern themselves. They don't exist by themselves. And they generally don't arise because we have, in the moment before, decided for them to do so. Right? That's why we get so surprised and taken aback by what we see arising. Where did that come from? It seems to have its own power. I didn't ask for that. Then Shantideva says, the assembled conditions have no thought to produce a suffering result. Nor does the resultant suffering think, I was produced from conditions. There is no mind, no consciousness, no agent in each of these aspects, in each of these conditions. None of them exist independently. Why is that important? Why is that understanding that? As the Buddha taught in terms of the 12-fold path, 12-fold dependent origination. Why is that our actual key into freeing ourselves? Shantideva says, thus all effects arise from other conditions, which in turn depend upon previous conditions, and previous conditions, and previous conditions. And nowhere will we find anything, no matter how small or large, it has its own agency. And what that means is that in every aspect of every action and its consequence, each of those aspects in its nature is free, is not bound, is not determined. Thus, we are always living and acting within an ongoing creation, in which something different is possible. Shantideva says, therefore, all things are like illusions. They're not independent. When we really deeply realize this, our anger will dissipate and dissolve. And that is the key. That in understanding karma and understanding our cycles in practice, we're not just getting more adept at letting go, but needing to forever be vigilant in guarding the door, lest some dust blow in, but rather realize that the dust, what we perceived as the obstruction, is not what we think it is. It does not have the power we give to it. And then going larger, we can think, what is the relationship between karma and justice? You know, our sense of fairness says that people who live good lives within kindness and generosity should be rewarded, at least not punished, seemingly from the way their lives unfold. And that those who don't live that way maybe at least should not be rewarded for acting badly, causing others harm. In other words, that there should be some correlation that we see between people and their actions. It should matter. If it doesn't matter, then why would it matter how anybody acted? And in an ordinary level, that's probably one of the easiest motivations to be motivated by. Right? I would like to do this, but I'm not going to do this because if I do, all hell's going to come down. And I don't want that. And obviously, a lot of times, that's not enough to stop us from doing that. And this has been recognized in Buddhism since the beginning. The 19th ancestor in India said, we see both wholesome and unwholesome results occurring in the world throughout time. All kinds of actions taking place at the hands of people. Ordinary folks deny cause and effect when they see kind and fair-minded people who suffer and die young, while those who are violent or unjust prosper into old age. Such ordinary folks say neither crime nor beneficial actions bring consequences. In other words, it doesn't seem to matter what you do, how you live. They don't realize that the consequences of our actions follow us for 100, 1,000, or 10,000 eons. Now, of course, that becomes very, very real in a very long-term way if we understand or have faith in the Buddhist teaching of rebirth. But even aside from that, the consequences of our actions are resonant within your consciousness in every moment. Now, we have all clever kinds of ways to hide that. We suppress it, we rationalize it, we numb it out, we distract ourselves, so we don't actually see the consequences of our actions that are not helpful. And the inner results of that. But that doesn't mean they're not there. And of course, we see this all over the place. Why do the good die young? Why do the forces of anger and hatred and violence and suppression of rights and freedoms gather so many supporters? How does that happen? So many ordinary people are drawn towards promises and deceptions. How does greed, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy become so large, so popular? So we see how a seed within a person accumulates within ourselves, right? When we indulge it in our mind, when we grasp onto it, when we believe in it, when we give it energy. And then we see how like-minded people can band together and bring all of their individual seeds and expand those, their views, desires, intentions, into an ideology, a dogma, a cause, a tribe that becomes based on the condition that others must be denied, subjugated, diminished, controlled. We see how the very same things can function, where people bringing their seeds together, if you will, our intentions, our virtues, our aspirations, and bring them together and expand them into a living organism that is dedicated not to harming, but to actualizing good, not to destroying, but to affirming life, and to trying to awaken that in all beings. We call that a sangha. So these questions of morality, of conflict, of the individual versus the group, of human beings versus or alongside the universe, life and death, cause and effect, these are ancient concerns. Like, how does all this work? How is it working? And where are we in it? And what is our responsibility as human beings? But there's another motivation for the bodhisattva, which goes beyond just our own practice and alleviation of suffering. It goes beyond wanting to alleviate suffering of others and to bring good into the world. When the alignment in your heart and your mind, when your intentions and your actions become so unified, so integrated, they begin to disappear. There's less need for outer motivations, for rewards. There's less dependence upon hoped-for results. The action itself more and more becomes complete. Think about just the simple practice of mindfulness in training, here at home, when you're doing one thing. Think about the concentration practice. Think about one moment of zazen. And that when there's no before and after, there's no expectation of what that will bring, how that's going to evolve or change you or help you in your life with others. When all of that drops away for a moment and there's just one undivided moment, one total instant, That's why we call it mind training. In that moment, we are training our mind to gain faith in that, to begin to allow that, accept that, and begin to actually experience it as a completeness. When we understand karma more deeply, it frees us to not depend so much on expectations and outcomes and probabilities, at the same time that we are striving to be very skillful in our actions. So this tradition goes back a long way. In the time of the Buddha, during the monsoon seasons, when the Buddha and the Sangha were not able to travel, were not allowed to travel, actually, they would gather together. And pretty quickly in the Buddha's own lifetime, in the very beginning, the monastics would build a simple hut structure to live in for those 3 months to the rainy season, just to protect themselves. But at the end of the rainy season, they had to dismantle it, right, and take it apart. And then the next rainy season, they'd have to build another one. And you can imagine the rule that they had to take it apart because, you know, you got all this work to build this thing and you found a nice sweet spot. And you think, oh, what a shame, you know, I'd like to come back here next time and save me a lot of effort. But they were practicing renunciation. They were wandering monastics, not accumulating. But pretty quickly, they began to be given places and shelters by lay patrons where they could gather together. And the remnants of those, when we were in India a few years ago on our pilgrimage, we went to some of one of those places that was actually the Buddha's, one of his favorite retreat locations during the rainy seasons. And that's discerned by the number of times that the Buddha went there. And so he speaks about it, it sort of is recorded. I don't remember exactly how, whether it's in the sutras or elsewhere, but it's recorded where he spent each of the rainy seasons. So you see the places where he kept returning to. So he did have his favorite spots. And so, and that continued. And in our tradition, in the Zen tradition, and particularly in the Soto tradition, we call it Ango. And as I said earlier, it is a way traditionally where it was primarily monastic practice, where the monastics who might be at their home temples or might be traveling in between Angos would gather at certain monasteries where they wanted to study. They wanted to study with a certain teacher. And they would all gather together and basically create a Sangha just for those 3 months and train. And so given our conditions, where we have a small monastic community, a very large lay community, it made natural sense to open that up, as Dharmarishi did many years ago, and make Ango something that the whole Sangha participates in. So it's not quite that closed cloister, but rather it's a more porous body and training hall in which we're all creating this together. As part of that, there is the appointment of the chief disciple, in this case, Chike. And that is part of, it's a training position, so it's stepping up a little bit into the light and providing an example, again, just by practicing sincerely. So the chief disciple's role is really to be a sincere and dedicated practitioner, which by the time someone is in this position, as Chike is, that is nothing new. And to, in that way, in a sense, in a very quiet way, by showing up, both at home, in lots of moments that we won't see, but also in her times here, during sessions, where we'll be training together, we have the benefit of her example. Her bio, short bio, was presented in the Ango letter, but I wanted to mention that she first came in 1994 and became a student of Dada Roshi's, did Jikai in 2001. Her name, Chike, means wisdom jewel, the Mani jewel, has raised a child, still raising?
No, she's
grown. No, that's done. But still a mother. Originally trained as a nurse, went to law school, became a lawyer, and has been for a number of years at the University of New York School of Law in Brooklyn.
CUNY.
Long Island City. And is currently the Associate Dean of Enrollment Management and Access Initiatives, and is the fairly recent Executive Director of the City University of New York School of Law's Pipeline to Justice program, which is trying to provide access to law school for those who have been historically excluded from access to the legal profession. She's been a student here, as I said, for many, many years, and was part of the founding group in Brooklyn at the Temple of the Beyond Fear of Differences. Really was one of those few students who at the very beginning put in a lot of both group time and smaller group time to try to bring that into being, to develop that, and was there really at every step along the way as we found our way and continued to find our way to where we are now. She currently is on the board of directors and has been on the board of directors for some years, and as a recent part of that, the board's work was part of a subcommittee to help develop the Mountains and Rivers Order ethics guidelines, and in particular create an ethics committee which could deal with ethical, moral transgressions that might take place within the Sangha. So part of the chief disciple's journey is in this process towards becoming a senior student. And the senior students play a very important role within a Sangha by virtue of their practice and their experience and their maturity that is both Dharma maturity, understanding of the Dharma, and their living of that Dharma, and also the maturity and the understanding that comes out of actually being in the Sangha over years. And over those years, this student has the opportunity to go through a lot of different things. Good times, not so good times. Different challenges that arise within every Sangha as we grow and evolve together. Disturbances large and small. Times of abundance, times of want. And they keep showing up. That's the thing. They keep showing up and they keep practicing. And they use that to strengthen their faith in the Dharma and in the teachings, and in the Sangha. And that is not a small thing, and it doesn't come another way. It doesn't come another way. You can't just arrive with that. It's really what creates the deepest bonds that we have. It happens over time. I was telling somebody recently that I remember when I was a young child, probably around 12, 13, was thinking about these things. My grandparents, one set of grandparents, were deeply, deeply in love. And you knew it. You could see it. And even at that young age, when I knew so little about love, although I would have challenged you if you'd questioned it at that age, but I remember watching them and thinking, I don't know what that is, but I think the only way they have been able to find that is because they have stayed together this long. I know what it's like to fall in love, to, you know, to have the rush of that, but I knew that I didn't know this. It's kind of like that. And so it's a transition to becoming a senior student, and in that way, being able to serve even more in many different ways, many of which are seen, but many of which are not. Just as many of the ways that Shikei has been serving, many of the ways in which she's been serving have not been seen, at least not by the larger Sangha. And that's okay. Right? It's not all done so that it can be seen. It's done for the benefit of the Sangha. And she's a strong New Yorker with a strong sense of the... right. But with a but with a strong sense of the mountain within. So she's got feet in both places. And so during these 3 months, we will practice daily. We will, those of us who are doing the Ango formally, there are readings, we'll be doing quite a bit of study and really be digging into the subject of karma, looking at it in many different ways, through the Fusatsus and Dharma encounters, the Ango intensive that we'll be doing later in the Ango, we'll be looking at this, we'll be pulling from different teaching stories and koans as a way, another way of looking at karma. And all of it, you know, both to understand it in terms of the teachings, but all of it in terms of its relationship to you and me and us and us. Because that's its point, is to understand how to be in this world well. How to be in this world well. And so off we go. We will not have our hike. We decided not to have our hike. We thought we could, but I was a little concerned about taking a large group of people up the mountain, out into the community. I don't know. So we're not. But the spirit of the hike is still with us. And Hobai is going to be offering some tea, which somebody will say a little bit more about, yeah, as we finish. Okay, so thank you all for joining us this morning. And this is just the beginning of a very rich and full period of time together. And so please come back, keep coming back, because it's the Sangha that makes Ango, Ango, right? This oceanic gathering. So I'll end with a poem. Everywhere the sound of sirens, everywhere a hand extends. This day, so much need. This day, so many possibilities. How is it that the frail and fragile songbird travels thousands of miles every year? If you want to know, enter the mountain gate for the autumn training period. Your body and mind is no different than those who came before. Yet today it's in your hands. Please, followers of the way, bring forth your one bright pearl so others too may know for themselves. Don't be just one. Make yourself larger.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.